Toll free number 888-938-4643.
'Career in horse racing off to a fast start? Well, the University of Arizona's Racetrack Industry Program is your winning ticket. The Racetrack Industry Program has served as a springboard to some of the industry's most successful individuals, with a proven track record of job placement right out of college. If you want to earn a degree in the exciting horse racing industry, the Racetrack Industry Program can put you in the winner's circle.
Visit ua-rtip.org today.
At the races with Steve Bick. Enough! Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back. And Pat Cummings has jumped in, and the deck keeps getting reshuffled here. Dick Powell, Pat Cummings, Rick Hammerly.
But before we go any further, you know, Steve, we can't do at least a part of the show without getting some food mentioned in. And
true.
I was just given a Ron Forche favorite that was told to give to you. Looks like from Cortez Farm. It's Cajun seasoning.
Ooh, so sweet.
They drop it off on the table. You got two people just dropping stuff off, all kinds of stuff. So, anyways,
for me?
This is from
me
Ron Forche. Yes, I was just handed it.
I'm sending.
Pass it down the road to Steve.
I'm sending Tina another box. I keep sending stuff home to New York, and this looks tremendous. Cortez Farm Cajun seasoning.
There you go.
How great is this? For orders, Arsenault Cajun seasoning. If you don't know how to spell Arsenault, it's actually this.
Got to have an X in there somewhere.
This does, although you know you got Ray Arsenault up in Toronto, the NHC champion.
ULT
is ULT, which is more of a French Canadian influence. And this is how about this? What's going on here?
Field trip.
Nice, very nice. I love it. Arsenault, ARCENEAUX, CajunSeasoning.com, and looks tremendous. I it's funny. What's the Cajun seasoning that's out on the distributed? I think it's Tony Cacheri, I believe, is the brand. And I think I not long ago, I think this past summer, with the new grill, with that new barbecue grill Tina bought for me for Father's Day, although my career batting average on fatherhood was zero. So
grandfatherhood.
Grandfather, yes. Yeah.
Hallmark, gotcha.
All right. Arsenault, CajunSeasoning.com. And if Fauché gives it the okay, then it's got to be good. It's made for Ron's farm. Add a little spice to everything you eat. And here's Chad Chexnader. Sacharis. I knew I was close. Is that it? Chad? Sacharis. I was close though with Tony's Sacharis. And since we mentioned Louisiana, a quick hit from yesterday. Two things. The Mardi Gras, went to the stall filly. Oh my God! Come on,
something tea.
Yeah.
Where's Nick Tamaro?
He's not. It's huh?
I read it last night on TDN.
Oh, for goodness' sakes!
I can't
the one that kind of jumped to the lead and just never looked back. And actually, I needed to pull this out. Anyhow, here we go. I'm sorry. I my mind is just not sharp today. LZ.
Oh,
there we go. LZ. I will mention, though, you know, we had Kevin Kilroy on for the first time. And Kevin talked about that mile turf race that started the pick four. And he particularly zeroed in on Shirley for Al Stahl. And that first-time starter, ended up floating from 10 to 1 to 13 to 1, blew the turn, actually, and lost a lot of ground. Otherwise, would have absolutely won that race at a big price. So, terrific push by Kevin. Just had to settle for second. I think it was the, wasn't it the, I think it was the Stidham that, pretty sure it was the Stidham, or no, it was Brendan Walsh, maybe? I think the Brendan Walsh won that race. Anyway, fun Mardi Gras day, and I saw lots of great images from
afar.
Yeah, from New Orleans, and for Mardi Gras day. All right, we've got to do, we've got to get our man, right, on the
Chairman
phone,
Kane.
So let me call Adam and get him on here.
Well, you're calling Adam. We can do a little more food talk as it's Pat's first time to Hot Springs.
First time.
We gave him a little tour yesterday of the downtown, hit the Ohio Club, which is a must, and pointed out a breakfast spot that you hit this morning, the Pancake House.
Yeah, just a classic kind of diner. My wife is not from America, and it was her first time experiencing grits. So we had a My Cousin Vinny moment this morning in the pancake shop with the waitress asked me, do you want some grits with that? I said, sure, I'll take some. And my wife looks to me, she says, what's a grit? So we had a whole My Cousin Vinny moment with that, and I compared it to Hong Kong with congee. Because congee is like a rice porridge, and so there are some similarities there. And but no, the really interesting place, Rick, and I appreciated the tour yesterday and getting around in Hot Springs, and wish you know, have reason to come back for some bigger racing too.
I will also add on the breakfast front, the best cafe. You might want
the best. All right.
Well, the best.
Okay.
And they've got the adorable cottages that they completely have renovated. It was literally a 30s motor court hotel, not a hotel but a motel. And I watched as they were starting the renovation like 5-6 years ago. Yeah. And not only is it complete, they're actually took over the place next door, and they're doing that as well. There's a lot of this, you know, that's going on around Hot Springs, but the cafe was closed in the 60s, apparently, and it's adorable. It's always packed, and the food is fabulous. Best cafe on Washita.
And the place right down the street from me, with the sports theme and the college theme, the biscuit, the...
Oh, the English muffin.
The English muffin.
Which is hysterical. The English muffin is very good, actually. I wandered in there that one year that I stayed out in the lake the first time. The English muffin, quite good, too.
This town is not lacking for food. You can go to some places and spend time and you go, oh, my gosh, I got to eat the same place night after night. It's got a little bit of everything, and so it's sustainable to stay here for the entire meet, which I will, and not get tired of the food.
Well, and the strongest surprise here is the pizza game, because DeLuca's, of course, which we talk about all the time, and Anthony is out of town, but he's back on Thursday. There's also Squeeze Box, also on Washita, that is excellent.
I've been to Squeeze Box.
David Hill.
Grateful Head. Rocky's across the street from the track. Does a great pie. So,
but DeLuca's has expanded the menu too. Anthony has widened the appeal. Pat Cummings has widened the appeal of breakage. What a fabulous segue! And coming to us from Northern Kentucky, Adam Koenig joins us. Adam, well done. You took Pat's hand off and are running with it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. And yeah, we're filed a series of bills, one of which is a paramutual modernization bill, I'm calling it, and breakage is part of it. And like I said last time I was on, I first heard of it on your show with when you first had Pat on, and talked to Pat individually with at dinner with Damon Thayer one night, and talked about it, and here we are.
Unbelievable, and we understand that the prospects are more than good. It's more of a likelihood, but Pat, fold in here and you know, give a quick survey again for those that you know, they know the term breakage. They somewhat understand that, you know, the 10-cent moniker and New York, the nickel moniker. What has been the goal here?
So pretty much across the landscape of North American thoroughbred racing and almost all pari-mutuel racing just about anywhere in the world, the dividends are not rounded down. They're not rounded to the nearest penny. So you lose a certain amount of money. And I think the best way to think about this is place and show betting, okay? So let's say you are betting a horse, or very that many people do anymore, bet a horse who's even money to show. And the return comes back $2.20. So you're making 10% on your $2 bet. If you had penny breakage, which is what is being proposed in House Bill 607 and the raft of legislation that Adam has offered here, in Kentucky, to any Kentucky track, Kentucky Downs, Churchill, Keeneland, doesn't matter, Ellis, Red Mile, Oak Ridge, if the math worked out that you were owed $2.38, you would get $2.38 instead of the $2.20. And that adds up over time. In the last 5 years in Kentucky, we've estimated roughly $35 million has been held back as breakage, about $7 million a year over that period of time. And nationwide, we think it's about $50, $60 million a year. So it's a substantial amount of money that is taken and retained penny by penny across all of the bets that are out there. And Kentucky would be the first in American pari-mutuel history to round to the nearest penny, as opposed to nickel in New York or dime in almost every other state.
For those that need further clarification, think of the scene with Ron Livingston and Jennifer Aniston in the car in Office Space, where he is trying to explain to her how we're just taking pennies, and it's not going to amount to much. It's very that's exactly what this is. And when you go to the ATM, well, in this case, to your ADW account, those pennies are going to show up. And what's fascinating about this, Adam, you know, you understand, of course, the technical portion of rulemaking and the legislation. Explain that the terminology that's in the bill and that governs this policy, you literally are changing one word.
Yes, from dime to penny. That's all it took. And now, if it was only just that, you know, it would be a very simple bill. But it has a lot of other moving parts to it. After our pari-mutuel wagering task force, necessitated by the clear legalization of historical horse racing. But yeah, it just takes one word, and you know, hopefully we're going to get it done this year. And if we do, you know, Kentucky will be the best, most interesting, and most profitable place to bring your wagering dollar. And, you know, I suspect it will catch on, but, you know, as a Kentuckian, I won't be upset if it doesn't, frankly.
And it's different in every state, in every jurisdiction, but explain where breakage money in Kentucky goes now these days at the end of the year.
I'm pretty sure Pat can explain that better than I can.
Yeah, it's a split basically between the track, and then the track is splitting their portion between themselves and the horsemen at basically a 50-50 split, and the state gets a small portion of it. But it is not substantial revenue compared to what has happened with the HHR. In 2021, I think the state is currently only getting. And the horsemen are only getting pieces of on-track breakage, live money handle in Kentucky, whereas it is the ADWs, the bet takers in other places, who are retaining breakage is retained at the bet taker level, not at the. It is not remitted back to the stage or to the individual track. So this is something that will apply to anyone who is betting on Kentucky racing anywhere. On your ADW, if you're in New York and betting on Churchill, you're going to get, hypothetically, $2.88 instead of $2.80 as you were getting now. And it's going to apply all the way up the, you know, you got 100 $100 exacta today. It might be $100.18 after this bill passes and is signed, hopefully. Still has to pass the Senate, has to pass the House, has to pass the Senate, and then would have to be signed by Governor Beshear. But as the chairman said, it feels we're hopeful. We're very hopeful for it. And a point that I think Chairman Koenig has made incredibly well over the course of this, the task force hearings earlier in 2021, historical horse racing in Kentucky has been incredibly well received by the customers who enjoy playing the machines, the owners who enjoy the purse supplements, the trainers and the jockeys who enjoy those as well. The state, surely, the operators have enjoyed it. This is now one for the horse players. And yes, the horse players kind of came at the end, but if this passes, I think it would be a really great piece of momentum for horse players across the country. It is not easy to change these provisions. It requires political capital. It's something that Thoroughbred Idea Foundation approached New York about and tried working with NYRA a couple of years ago, and we're told it's low on the list. And understandably.
Well, NYRA, you make the point, though, that New York, NYRA is already better than anywhere else.
Correct. And that was the great work of Steve Crist in the 1990s.
Pay to the nickel.
Yep. For all under $10 increments, pay to the nickel. And as a result, New York has given back countless millions more than any other jurisdiction. But Kentucky will take the lead here if this takes place. And as the chairman said, maybe other states will follow. Maybe they won't. It's going to take a lot. But I think when people start seeing it, it will hit. And very rare, we don't talk about place and show betting much. It becomes so much more competitive to not lose, say, 10% of your profit, which is currently being retained on some of the, and has been forever. So this will be a big change, very hopeful. And if I could just ask Adam a quick question, are we expecting a hearing on this next week, Chairman?
Well, I'm hopeful. I spent my morning going from office to office, talking to my colleagues, explaining all four of my bills, and talking about this one and finding out where everybody is, and making sure that people are up to date and understand the breakage in particular. After we talk about the main idea behind it, which is to generate more revenue from these HHR machines for the general fund, then that's the next thing I bring up, and nobody has any objection to it. And thus far, the complaints from the track have been minimal. And let me just say that, when you talk about other states, I'm in a unique position that we've just given certainty to HHR. Everyone's expanding. They just announced a new satellite location for Ellis Park in Owensboro yesterday. Bowling Green satellite for Kentucky Downs has been open for a month and is doing quite well. And so, it's an opportunity to say, hey, you have all this other money coming in. This is something that you can give up that other states aren't going to have, because it's just a flat out cost. Now the one track that balked a little bit, I pulled out my best Pat Cummings and I said, well, you come back after you talk to the business people and talk and figure out what churn is and figure out what the additional money that will be wagered, because you're be offering the best product, and then tell me what your cost is going to be. And I haven't heard back yet, so I'm guessing those numbers were probably pretty decent.
Well, and that's the topic. That is the rejoinder, is the churn. And are there estimates on what that might represent?
There are, and we did them back in 2018 when we published the first white paper, and they are truly just estimates. I mean, we presented some things to New York on this. At the end of the day, I think this is the best way to figure it. When breakage existed in its current form today at the dime, that money is being withheld and paid once. It's going to however that state divides breakage, or if it's to the bet taker themselves, they're getting that money once. If we give that money back to the horse players, if it's deposited in your ADW account, if it's paid out to you on track, you now have that money to go bet again. And the value of the takeout cycle that recreates, that churn is more than the value of the breakage retained individually.
Exactly. This is the same exercise that was involved with the Treasury Department and the frustrations that Peggy Hendershot would encounter when she tried to go explain to Congress critters that if you change the withholding guideline, you're going to get more tax revenue. And they were like, what?
Yeah.
How's that possible? Because it was too hard to explain. And much like what Adam just explained with the changing of one word in the provision, it's the same thing that happened in the Treasury Department, that they changed the wording of the value of the bet and the value of the ticket that eliminated 90% of the signers in one fell swoop.
The chairman has also dropped bills for sports betting legalization in Kentucky, for problem gambling expansion, and to put a lot more funding and resources into problem gambling. And a tremendous amount. I saw a statistic yesterday, Chairman. I was blown away. The bill suggests an extra $225 million, I think it is, for problem gambling resources in Kentucky. Nationwide, the total's about $75 million that's been committed to that. Kentucky's coming way over the top. A fantastic step there, and I think a lot of support will be had for that. Getting rid of the gray slot machines, essentially, the gray machines in the bars and restaurants, truck stops, things like that. There's a lot there and a tremendous amount of work from Adam and his colleagues to get to this point. And it looks, I don't know if all of it's going to get through this cycle, but I'm very hopeful.
Well, Adam can appreciate this reference, but you get those machines out of the back rooms and they'll shut down Newport, Kentucky. Adam, we can't have that.
It's ironic. I mean, they spent all those years cleaning up Newport, and now we have a legal HHR facility there, and these gray machines are popping up in restaurants everywhere.
They are.
It's humorous almost, but it's a unique and on the problem gaming thing. We require nothing in Kentucky for problem gaming that any of the operators do, and this $225 million will be put into a trust. And it is from a lawsuit over PokerStars continuing to operate in Kentucky from the first governor of Beshear. And we just got the $225 million last year in the settlement. And my goal is to have the state live off of that, or the trust, basically, to do the job, live off the interest.
Wow.
And that should be the last... The state may ever have to think about funding for it. And what better use of what, is basically technically illegal gaming monies than to deal with this issue in perpetuity.
Wow.
So we're not going to spend $225 million a year every year, but it's a one-time investment should last us forever.
Wow, that's amazing. That's tremendous.
Well, Kentucky, I forget that I'm a Kentucky guy now.
You spend your
Kentucky Downs.
I work at Kentucky Downs, but Kentucky in itself has really taken a huge step forward in the game and said, you know what, we're going to do things the right way. And I always say, no matter what you're doing, the time to make these changes and do them is when you're
when
on a roll.
When you have them, exactly.
Not when you have to, when you
yes.
can. And
100%.
And I think we've made a lot of mistakes in the industry of sitting back and waiting and playing defense. The time to play offense is when you have the ball.
And to that point, I mean, now is the time certainly to approach the sports betting topic. Money is clearly crossing the river into Indiana plentifully. If you head over there to the Horseshoe or just across from Louisville, you see the cars in the parking lot. You see the Kentucky license plates. It happens down in Tennessee. The state is practically surrounded. Ohio is due to implement sports betting very soon. And as the chairman said the other day, there's about a 40-mile stretch of border on Kentucky that touches Missouri that is the only part that is right now uncovered of a place you could go and get sports betting. And Missouri is considering it at present. So, the fact that Tennessee has had this and had it for as long as it has and Kentucky hasn't... is maybe a little surprising, but the time is right and to get moving on all these things.
How far, Adam? What is your sports betting prospects from what you can tell so far?
I think they're decent. We're going to, like I said, I'm talking to my colleagues and looking to find out, and I'm also finding out if they want to take four different votes on gaming bills, or if I got another bill that rolls them all into one, and if they would just like to take one vote. But
we'll call them Omnibus Koenig after this.
Exactly. Omnibus Freedom is what I like to think of it as. So.
Well done. And Adam is, in terms of serving the racing community, and of course, I'm sure watching with interest as you drive past the new Turfway Park as it rises and as construction continues.
It's looking good. They hope to be open in July.
Excellent.
And we're going to know here in the next 5 weeks, 6 weeks here, because the session does not go past the middle of April. So we'll have clarity here in the not-too-distant future.
Adam, is there anything your constituents and anybody in Kentucky can do? I always ask you this, and
yes.
We worked on it with HHR. What should Kentucky residents do to support this?
Thank you, yes. Legislature.ky.gov. And you can find your legislator, senator, and representative and email them and ask them to be for bills 606 through 610. But specifically the parimutuel breakage one is 607. And I think I've got the number right, 800-372-7181. But, emails work quite well. And everybody sees them pretty quickly. So, legislature.ky.gov.
Excellent. Adam, I know you got a committee meeting. I appreciate this immensely. Well done. Thanks from horse players, not just in Kentucky, but most likely everywhere, because if this domino falls, it could trigger widespread application around the industry.
Well, thanks, and I hope to have, when Pletcher comes on after he won a bunch of stakes, to have the victory calls toward the end of session. Sound good?
I love it. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Right.
Happy to do that with you.
Oh, thank you.
Adam Koenig, everybody. We appreciate what he's been able to do, and, his... I started hearing from him, I don't know, maybe 8 or 9 years ago, I guess, give or take. And he happened onto the show, and being that Turfway Park was right in his riding.
He's a huge fan.
District. Yeah.
He just loves the stuff.
Yeah.
Well, we got to thank Pat here, too, for pushing
and,
things.
And Steve for the interview back in 2018.
Right. And that just shows you where are we in 2022. How long? This is not
things like this take.
Right. So other states. Hopefully, maybe there's been some other states working behind the scenes that we don't know about.
And we haven't talked about it, Steve, ourselves. But the Category 1 advance in Oklahoma. It's a starting point for revising the rules, and it still needs the governor's signature. So there's no argument that it's not fully over the line, but it's expected as they approve a whole new raft of rules. But that was, all credit to the Oklahoma Commission. They came to me and we talked about it and talked about the options, and they're going to have a lot of help. The International Federation, the chief steward from Hong Kong is helping on the implementation and training with the stewards, and there's a lot of great support resources that are coming their way to bring along the Category 1 rules. I've seen some conversations, some dialogue in the public space about, how it's going to be received. We'll see, right? We'll see. There's plenty of time between now and then. They're not going it alone. I've heard about a lot of other jurisdictions that want to queue up behind them. Very exciting. I think Ontario, which I was expecting to take the lead on the Category 1 rules, I think they are right in behind. We've had a lot of good dialogue with them, so that's starting to move too. So we really have a lot of movement on these issues. And I know you want to get on to some more on the fixed odds side of things coming up. So that'll be that's another one that we're of course very supportive of. So it's been a great couple weeks, and we're hoping to keep the momentum going.
A quick question: two different areas on the breakage. How much mechanically? How different are some of the other jurisdictions when it comes to this particular approach?
Internationally?
No, domestically in the U.S. Not the category.
Yes.
I'm talking the breakage side.
In many ways, it is statutorily derived, so you have to change legislation. That there's a reference to the break somewhere in individual state law.
Paramutual and all the paramutual rulemaking.
Yes. And I know, you know, we tried tackling this with New York, and it was, well, we have to get Albany involved, and it's going to have to be with a lot of other things. But again, with all these things, once one person does it,
right,
the path becomes clear, and it's a lot easier to get in line behind and see what needs to happen. So
one part of this that I thought was a marketing opportunity was for an ADW to come forward and just do it themselves as a marketing opportunity, as an advantage in the marketplace to pay their customers to the nickel or to the penny.
And we know that some of the biggest players out there already get a full breakage rebate. It's part of their package. Players have told us specifically that's something that they receive already, but mainstream players have never gotten anything of the sort. And that's where I think the real impact on this is going to be felt. Very excited, and couple weeks to go, and as the chairman said, I hope we're hearing an interview in mid-April with all of these things that have been passed and some real substantive accomplishments for horse players.
Well, this is substantive, and it does show, Pat, that the dedication to these initiatives and to putting these balls in the air, I'm going to venture a guess that the Oklahoma dialogue may have come out of your approach to them about the disaster,
the pick six.
The pick six.
It's exactly. That's where the relationship really got started.
I figured.
We helped get that rule change where they were able to put in a rule that there was ambiguity as to how the pick six would be paid if there was a dead heat in one of the legs for a jackpot. We advocated for it to be very clear in favor of the player if there was a case of that. And that got the relationship started. The rule got implemented in late 2020. And I had the pleasure of running into the executive director at a model rules meeting, Kelly Caffey, at a model rules meeting in Chicago last year. We were talking about that, and this came up. And Category 1 came up, and it just kind of went from there.
That's great.
And he's like,
that's
our rule's a mess. We need to change
that's
it.
That's great.
So, yeah. So,
well done.
Real happy. And just got to keep pressing.
Pat Cummings, TIF, and we'll talk again.
Thanks, Steve.
Whenever. Any and every time. Dick Powell was still with us, and we're going to get that conversation in next also. I also got to get to Sid. But Dick, why don't you give us your take and your dissertation on the weekend?
Sunday, we had the Hong Kong Classic Cup. It's mile and eighth for four-year-olds. And it's an amazing story what Tony Cruz has been able to do with California Spangle. Blazing fast horse. Won his first race, 5 furlongs and 54 and change. Came back 108 and change. Then this year, he started out making his way up the grades. Tony trained him, raced him exclusively at 6 furlongs to get him fit for longer races. He didn't go from 6 to 7 to 8 to 9. He went from 6 to 8. He drew post 13 in the Classic Mile, made the lead, but had to use a little energy and got run down late by Romantic Warrior. Now he comes back last Sunday in the Classic Cup, which is a mile and eighth. Lone speed, clearly, but had a little bit of pressure. And is just able to go out in a masterful ride by Zach Purden. Just got him going. 23 and change, 23 and change, 23 and change, 23 and change. They turn for home. They can't make up any ground on him. He won by a length and a half, 146 and change. Looked tremendous doing it. And just a masterful time by Tony Cruz, who's now going to try the Hong Kong Derby, which is a mile and a quarter. And amazingly, Tony's won the race four times as a jockey and twice as a trainer. So now he's going to try to do it a third time. And Zach is back healthy, and Zach fits him like a glove. Mile and a quarter is still going to be a question mark, because when you look at the last 100 yards of the race, his head kind of comes up, which I don't like to see. And it wasn't from just someone next to him and him fighting, but I think he was pretty much gassed at the mile and an eighth. Now, can a slower-paced mile and a quarter around two turns be just as strenuous as a hard-paced mile and eighth around one turn? We'll see. But just amazing job by Tony just to keep running him at six, getting faster and faster. Ratings got so high now, he can only run in stake races. And wins a mile and an eighth, middle leg of the four-year-old Classic Series in Hong Kong. Just remarkable achievement. I was happy because I touted him last year after these two races and the Griffin races and thought he was an upcoming star. Then I did a big tout on him before the Hong Kong Mile. So naturally, he gets caught in that race. But he was just sensational last week. So he'll be back Hong Kong Derby. I think it's March 20th. And he'll get to go for a mile and a quarter. Again, some horses who've been kind of not in the Triple Crown series because they're more stout-type horses that weren't going to contest the shorter races anyways. But after racing against him the other night, I don't know who's really going to want to face him again other than you get an extra furlong to try to get by him. He's by Star Spangled Banner, who's has one of the favorites for the 2,000 guineas this year for Simon and Ed Crisford. I can't think of the name. But Star Spangled Banner is mostly a sprinter. But he won the Caulfield Guineas at a mile, and he beat So You Think in Australia before he came to Ascot, where he made a name for himself. Now as a size charisma up and down. He had some fertility issues in the beginning, but he's been good recently, and he's out of a high chaparral mare, which gives tons of stamina on the bottom side of the pedigree. So he might be the perfect blend of speed, stamina, perfect blend of trainer, jockey, and we'll see if he can get the Hong Kong Derby.
Nice. You're wearing a Happy Valley hat, actually.
I'm coordinated, Steve. You're very, that?
Very.
Happy Valley.
Well done. Well
Happy
done.
Happy Valley hat. Wow.
There were a couple of decent $30 types. Zach Burton, I saw three winners, two for Karis Teton and two for Joe Marrero, too. They sort of dominated the three big names, of course, on the rider side. What's the weekend look like at Chateau?
Weekend back Saturday night, Sunday morning. No stake race this week. Got a big, I don't have my computer. We have a big all-weather race. And those races go very fast. Yeah, I'll be doing the times, and then I'll see like 108 flat, 108.1, and it's usually an all-weather race at Chateau. So when the Chateau track got a little wet over the winter from rain, that kind of speeded up the all-weather track. So they go super fast over that course, and they're fun to watch, get big feels, and they train on it constantly. So they're well used to getting over it. So nice 10 handicap races and a couple of short fields from what I could see from the entries. I know they'll be pushing to get a couple more horses into the first two races, but a couple of short fields and then the rest are all full gates.
Nice. Dick is going to stay here because you certainly have got thoughts and opinion for our next topic and our next guest. We're coming to you from the National HBPA Convention getting underway today, and we've got the opportunity to, you know, always touch on the variety of topics that come to the surface. And if there has been one horseplay arena that is being debated almost on a daily basis when it comes to the magical internet, the prospects for fixed odds wagering in North America. And of course, this all first started to come to the fore in discussions with Dennis Drazen, who was willing to do virtually anything to bolster Monmouth Park. And the let's call it the education curve that is going to be required is extensive. And it's not just a question of an education of the horse player about what constitutes fixed odds, but the marketplace that is going to be new to a lot of people. I mean, if you are not somebody that takes an interest in the international racing, you're gonna want to. And we got the perfect pair to broach this with, the unique opportunity to introduce Richard Ames, the CEO of CIS Group, and Michelle Fisher, who we haven't talked to in too long, and of course Michelle working as a North American boot on the ground ubiquitous presence when it comes to dealing SIS Sports Information Services. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks,
Steve.
Good to be
here.
Richard and Michelle, the question is where to start. Where are we as a American, let's confine it to American or North American wagering, where do we stand in terms of the introduction, the wider introduction of fixed odds wagering to the marketplace, essentially?
Well, Steve, it's really kind of funny when you talk about how long it has taken for things to happen in horse racing, because in 2018, I was right here at the National HBPA conference and speaking about fixed odds. The time we were anticipating the repeal of PASPA, we were looking at what sports wagering would do to horse racing, and we started to talk about it. So I go way back in advocating for fixed odds in America. And what's happened here since PASPA was repealed, we currently have about 30 states that now have legalized sports betting. And it begs the question, now that sports wagering is here, it's changing our culture. It's everywhere you look. Sports books are spending a huge amount of money to promote themselves. Not just acquisitions, to get players. You know, I heard the number now collectively, the sports books have spent over $3 billion to date on promotions. And we have to ask ourselves, where does that leave horse racing? We're currently not on any of these sports books. And there are a number of players or potential players that could be introduced to horse racing. And instead of looking at it from the fact of, let's talk about the horse players as your audience is, let's look at this. Let's take the state of Colorado. There are 825,000 account holders. How many of them do you think bet horses? Don't know that answer, but I can tell you what, they're playing table tennis for $100 million in table tennis in a year. And, you know, horse racing has a huge opportunity to get in front of a new audience. And that audience are not the audience that comes to the racetrack. They're not the audience that's going to be signing up for the ADW. These are people that are looking to bet on wherever there's action. And horse racing, if you look at it globally, we have, it's a 24-hour sport. There is racing from somewhere, sometime. And to fill in all of that time on a sports betting app when there's not a ball game, horse racing would be perfect. And, you know, since 2018, when I started talking about this and looking at, you know, how it's worked around the world, you know, I've joined SIS with Richard Ames here because they're already providing horse racing to sports books in over 50 countries. Even in places where there is no horse racing. They represent 118 race courses, including some of the big majors, including Ascot, Royal Ascot, Saudi, and it works very well. So I'll let my colleague Richard talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so, you know, we've been representing horse racing in the UK now for 30 years, and in the last 5-6 years, we've really broadened that range so that we now are taking content from Latin America all the way through Europe, the Middle East, and Asia through to Australia. And so we are able to offer betting opportunities to sportsbooks around the world every hour of every day with all of the associated video, audio, data that's required and pricing That's required for fixed odds purposes for the bookmakers to be able to create their books and manage their books properly. All of that service is pulled together in our facility. So we work very closely with the race courses to represent those rights. We pull them together and package them in such a way that they work optimally for sports books, which maximizes the revenue, and then that revenue flows back to those tracks. So we're delivering, $150 million plus a year back to racetracks through those fixed odds betting rights around the world.
That's been, I'm sort of speculating, that's been one of the questions that the racetracks have been asking, because, of course, the margins, the whole pricing structure is very different than the parimutuel market. Broach that, if you would, Richard, and maybe fold that into the challenges of the North American marketplace, aside from educating players as to, you know, as to how it's going to work. I mean, in terms of the content and putting it in the hands of players, what are those challenges?
So I think in terms of the commercials, we operate in a range of different ways with tracks, depending on how they would like us to represent their content. In general, you know, we don't have pools and we don't take a fixed amount out of the handle. You know, that's not the way this operates. There are commercial agreements in place with sportsbooks about their ability to either pay fixed prices or share revenues, which then flow through back to those race courses. And the numbers look very different. So, you know, if we're talking about 12, 15, 20% retention of certain a handle in certain parimutuel books, the prices will look very different on a fixed odds basis. You know, those numbers are much more likely to be 2, 3, 4%. However, when you look at the absolute amount of money that flows through based upon the turnover, it's perfectly possible, and indeed for most countries, you know, they generate much more revenue for the racetracks via the fixed odds product than they do via parimutuel. So this is really about how those commercials are constructed in order to make sure that everybody through the value chain gets a fair share of what's happening once that sportsbook product is created.
As a follow-up, immediately, I mean, there's more things I know that you want to flesh that out. But the first thing that comes to mind is what transpired in Australia and New Zealand with TAB, where they introduced the fixed odds on the app, and very quickly, fixed odds raced up in terms of a percentage of the total handle. And the concern, I mean, you're here at HBPA to talk to horsemen's groups and the horsemen's organizations about the concerns over the cannibalization of that parimutuel revenue. And, you know, is there going to be enough new incremental revenue from new players to offset whatever might come out of the parimutuel side? What's the answer to, you know, to industry, you know, not just stakeholders, but in fact track management that's listening and saying, you know, this is why we're concerned about making a go of this?
I think when we look at Australia, there's a couple things that aren't said. Australia had always, since the beginning of time, had bookmakers on track.
Sure.
And what happened in the early 2000s, two things happened. First, they had deregulation of the bookmakers. So that allowed more bookmakers to take horse racing, and everyone went online. And those were the two big things that pushed fixed odds. There were also changes in takeout at the time on the parimutuel side. So it was kind of like a perfect storm. Australia did a really good job with something called race field legislation, which basically, based upon the purse structure for the day at the track, set the percentage of takeout that went back to the track. They could either take that or the area could negotiate with the bookmakers for a percentage. So they had a very fair model, and that model didn't come easy. They went all the way to the Supreme Court to come up with that model. So, you know, a lot of times we gloss over what a success it was in Australia, and it is a success, and the money purses are higher in Australia now than they were before fixed odds, and it continues to grow. And the whole pie has grown there. But it didn't get there easy. And I think in the United States, if anybody tells you how much it's going to be, I tell you, they're lying, because we don't know. It's a different culture here. We are seeing great growth on the sports books. We're seeing a cultural change. But what what Fixed Odds could bring to us is a new audience, new bet types that we don't see on the tote. And this doesn't mean the tote goes away. The tote still has a place with pick end bets, pick sixes. There's sometimes, if you are a horse player, you're going to get better value on the tote than you are going to get on a Fixed Odds. But for those people, new people, who are already playing on sports, they can make that transition to horse racing because they know they bet a horse at 6-1, they're going to get 6-1. And so, yes, there will be some cannibalization because it's a horse player's dream here. I get to shop. I get to find value. For new people, we're introducing them to the sport. We will see leakage. There's no doubt that you'll see some handled transition over, but what we're looking to do here is grow the pie by bringing in a new audience. So that's, you know, that would be my answer to the racetracks. Is this something we should do or not? And I go back to the 1950s when horse racing had to decide, do we go on TV or not? This is when the NFL did, and horse racing chose not to. And see where we are today on television. And as a sport, its popularity. You know, you talk about Australia, you talk about England, horse racing is the number two spectator sport in both of those countries. In the United States, I don't know, you guys can guess, are we maybe eighth, ninth?
It's about right.
People don't grow up with horse racing. You don't go to a track unless somebody takes you. So this is just a huge opportunity to gain revenue that we're not getting at the moment. And as we spoke about earlier, the sports books are spending a tremendous amount of money to get people to go to those platforms. Horse racing should be there. You know, we're going to fall further into a niche sport if we don't go there. You know, they're going to be betting everything else but horse racing.
I've got an answer to that, and it also involves the potential. One of the things that I've maintained is there's this whole community, certainly people my age. You know, I'm 62, and you know, we always looked forward to going to Vegas because we could bet on sports. We could bet future bets and whatever, you know, whatever sports betting we wanted to do. For those that didn't grow up essentially in a city or in an environment where, you know, there was a bookmaker at the local tavern to, you know, to make book with. To me, The opportunity here is that there's all these sports bettors now that are getting this opportunity to have it right in their hand and, mm-hmm. and bet as they want. That grew up thinking, if I could bet on sports, I'd be killing it. And you know, basically, you know, looking at the lines in the paper all these years and thinking, oh, I would have been 6-7 this week. Then when all of a sudden you're actually putting your money up, it's something funny happens. Those odds makers in Vegas, they're pretty good at setting those numbers. It's not as easy to win as people seem to think it is. What I have maintained is that people that are now getting into a habit and practice of playing, of being able to sports bet, to bet at all, seriously, we needed to be in position to say, look, you got a much better fighting chance in this sport where you, in the parimutuel environment, you're betting against, you know, potentially less informed people and people that, you know, if you dedicate yourself to, you know, to becoming a successful handicapper and horse player, that you've got a chance to, you know, to beat the odds that, you know, that Vegas has honed to a fine, you know, a fine edge. I like the Fixed Odds, and I've always liked it because of what I learned through my wife as a mutual clerk. She pointed out some things to me, particularly with neophytes that would bet, you know, look at the board, have a horse picked 8-1 leading up to the race, and by the time everything, you know, all the dust settled and the bell rang, might have been 5-1, and they thought they were going to get close to $20, and they end up with $10 to $12, and they don't understand it. They're mystified, and to me, locking in a price was something for introductory players, even for serious multi-race players that are going to stay with the parimutuel market, having this as an option, being able to lock in over the course, you know, having both on the screen, you know, is a
we see that around the world.
Yeah.
Consumers who are able to fix a price like the fact that they can do that. It gives them a level of confidence in the product. It gives them a level of confidence in the relationship that they have with the bookmaker, which, as you've described, is difficult to explain to novices and people when it comes to parimutuel and late shifts in prices. And so that is one big advantage. And as Michelle has already said, where you have, you know, millions of sports bettors who've been encouraged into that way of thinking when it comes to other sports, when they can't have that on horse racing, it's a blocker. You know, and so I think if you know, the other thing that to add to what Michelle said about those sports books, you know, the age of those customers and the profile of those customers who are betting on the sports books are pretty different to your average horse racing bettor, and therefore the future and the ways in which that audience can come to this sport and be introduced to it in a way which is familiar to them from a betting point of view is a real opportunity.
You know, I spent 16 years of my career working for Tote. So to have me sitting here today talking about fixed odds, I believe that they can complement each other. It doesn't mean because we add fixed odds that the tote is going to go away. You know, as we said, for players, there is some value on the tote that you can't get on fixed odds for exactly what you just said, Steve. And, you know, one of the things, and we've heard people come in and talk about putting fixed odds at the racetrack. It's not what we're trying to do. We're trying to don't have a problem with it at the racetrack, but that's not where we should start. That's where you're going to get cannibalization of bulls. Because any person that walks into a racetrack, they're going to put on horses. And now you've suddenly said, hey, you can bet over here, you can bet over here. The player's going to love that. But if we want to grow the sport, we need to put it on a different platform. And we need to put it on a platform where the people are. People that aren't coming to the racetrack.
Agreed.
So, you know, our approach is a little different than others out there because we want to get it to the sports players. The traditional horse players, they're going to find it, and they're going to shop, and they're going to be very astute.
Talk about the concerns and the things that you, I'm sure, have read online for those that are critics of the concept, the critical mass, essentially, of having the market, have it work efficiently. What has to happen, Richard, to make this work on these shores?
Well, you know, the whole philosophy around fixed odds betting is not just about the fixing the price, but also because it's not dependent upon pools, then of course there is the opportunity to offer a huge range of bet types and the opportunity to be able to engage with the consumer in a very different way on price and competing on price. What that leads to is a need for the sports book and the bookmaker to have accurate pricing all of the time that those markets are open. And therefore, what the sportsbooks are looking for is, how can I have high quality information, high quality pictures and audio and presentation, and how can I have a comprehensive race program so that I'm never more than 4 or 5 minutes away from the next race and the next result, so that enthusiasts can, you know, bet through time and enjoy the overall experience. And so, sportsbooks are looking for a volume of content. They're looking for high quality content. They quite like to have it all day long. But what they really need is high-quality data and pricing information to be able to make sure that those books are working efficiently. There are plenty of providers in outside of the USA, and we're one of them. There are others who are able to provide some or all of these elements of a package for US operators. What we need to be able to do is to be able to engage with those sports books to be able to provide that solution in a way that we know works quite nicely outside of the UK, but in a format that's going to work really well for US consumers within those sports books and within those environments. And I think, you know, one of the things, you know, you can tell from my accent, I'm relatively new to this, but one of the things that I've been learning is each state is in a very different place, not just from a regulatory point of view in terms of what might happen with fixed odds, but also from the starting point in terms of how horse racing is funded within that state and how the various elements of the industry are supported within each state. And so, you know, where I might naively a year or two have thought there was going to be a US solution, it's pretty clear to me there is going to be a state-by-state solution. Mm. And therein lies the complexity and why this is going to roll out, you know, relatively slowly, because each state needs to understand the current situation and the impact that fixed odds might have within that. But you can tell that we're enthusiasts for this, and we believe that you know, there is a big opportunity to engage with a much bigger, broader market and to have more money flowing in the direction of horse racing and for the horse racing industry to benefit from all of that. And we just got to be really clear about how that's going to work in each state.
You mentioned Colorado.
Yep.
And 800,000 players that have an account in Colorado. We've heard how in New Jersey, one of the, I won't call it a mistake, but one of the initiatives that did not come to pass, come to fruition as fully as hoped, was the Betfair, in-market exchange wagering.
Yeah.
Because there wasn't the critical mass of players to mm-hmm. to make market, essentially. How is this different? Is it different? And flesh that out.
It is different because in the fixed odds world, you have no issue with liquidity. You're simply offering a price at any individual horse. If you only have one bet on one horse, the market's still valid and the bookmaker will strike the bet. So you don't have this issue of liquidity required to be able to strengthen the market. The market is the prices that the bookmakers, sportsbooks, offer you. And indeed, part of the opportunity is they can be as creative as they like around what type of markets they want to offer. So they'll offer head-to-head bets where you can pick two horses to mm-hmm. run against each other. They'll offer winning distance of the winner. They can offer markets without the favorite. They can offer extended places to different prices. There's all sorts of creativity. And there is no issue around liquidity to be able to make those markets valid. They're valid because the bookmaker has created prices and will stand the price when they offer you the bet.
And I think exchange wagering in the U.S. was, well, before its time. But you're also looking at, you had to find two players that were willing to take those bets, and it was for horse racing.
Yeah, exchange betting requires liquidity.
And and what we're looking at here is putting horse racing on established sports mobile apps in shops that already have players.
How does the industry, if you're in a marketplace, Colorado's got what? Arapahoe. If you're talking about a new audience, but at the same time, if the option is there for players to utilize this avenue, if money comes away from the parimutuel market, that's money out of purse accounts and so forth. I mean, how does the industry benefit under this approach?
A couple different ways. The first thing we have to remember in the United States is we have the Interstate Horse Racing Act. So we're not going to have any bookmaker taking horse racing and not paying for it. Basically, the Interstate Horse Racing Act requires consent from the host track, the host horseman, and the racing commission. So that's first and foremost. There's been a lot of talk about stealing that happens offshore, but everything we do has an agreement. So that's first and foremost. So a racetrack can stop it at any point in time. Secondly, they're going to get paid. As Richard talked about, there's various methods of ways in which a racetrack can get paid, and it can be a percentage of turnover. What we're looking at in a state like Colorado, who does have draft regulations in place for fixed odds wagering on horse racing, is that the industry stakeholders are going to receive, for lack of a better word, a source market fee on all horse racing that's bet on. So what we're banking on in a state like that, where Arapahoe is hanging on, barely hanging on, is we're looking to tap into a new market with horse racing, as much horse racing as we can put on, onto those sports apps, with a percentage of it going back for them to distribute. Not only if they're the host, they're going to receive the host fee, and if it's happening in that particular state, a percentage of that's going back to the local industry. So it's going to be set up a little different in each state. Louisiana is like a unicorn. And I say that because Louisiana actually gets 2.5% of the tax on all sports wagering goes to Louisiana bred horses. Now, there's a bill that just dropped today that's looking at allowing horse racing on sports books and put with a statutory fee of what goes back to the industry. And that's on top of what the host tracks receive. So we're going to see some different models in states to state, and we're also going to say, you know, how does this happen? Well, some states it's going to require a legislative change, and some states it's just going to be a rule change, adding horse racing as another sport. That's the easiest way to go. And when we try to mix it all up and put it at the racetrack, that requires changes of racing commission rules. So, you know, the quickest method is to allow it on a sports book. And what we've seen in some states, they naively wanted to protect horse racing and said, no horse racing on a sports book. And that, to me, did not let horse racing decide what their fate was. You know, Interstate Horse Racing Act is there to protect the tracks and the horsemen. We didn't really need that. So the path is going to be different in every state, maybe a little bit different percentage. But you remember, a company like SIS, and we're in a great position because we can bring in 30,000 international races to start. Now, you put what they've tried to do at MOM with a few stake races here, one or two racetracks, that's not enough critical mass,
right?
A, for bookmakers to even want to do an integration. It's not there all the time. The idea is just like an ADW now. You turn it on, and there's always horse racing from somewhere, somehow. So, you know, what we're looking to do is bring in the portfolio of racetracks and races that we have globally. And as American tracks are comfortable coming on board, add them in. You know, so we can get a real litmus test.
A couple of different follow-ups to that. You mentioned the draft rules. I know California had Jersey. You mentioned Colorado. How many states either have rules in place or are addressing or in the process of addressing a rule?
Thinking about it and addressing it, California was more of a paramutual. It was a
model.
Mix.
It was a mixed model?
It was a mixed model.
Okay.
Which I think would be terribly confusing for bettors. To suddenly, you're getting a fixed price on everything else, and then you go to horse racing, and you go, whoa, what happened? I don't like that model at all. I think it's confusing for the new people. And we're looking, you know, New Jersey is very different, and I think they're going to be very slow out of the gate because their legislation is not under sports betting and it's not under racing. It's its own animal, and I think it's very complicated to implement. Whereas in Colorado, it is going to fall under sports wagering. Louisiana, under sports wagering. I know of some other states contemplating it, but we don't have any draft rules or anything out at this time.
Also, what is the prospect for you adding to your portfolio North American signals to export?
Yeah, well, look, we'd love to do that. We've had a relationship with Philly Parks for 20-odd years now where we've been doing that for a long time, mainly into the UK, but now distributed to many countries around the world. And we're in conversations with various tracks in the country to do exactly that. And the revenues we can generate are either from our international customer base, but of course, as and when US states do start to regulate fixed odds betting over here, then we'd like to be able to represent that content in the US as well.
Well, it's very interesting that Parks is involved, Greenwood being British origin.
Bill yep. Hogwood was he was.
So
yeah.
they,
I mean,
Dieter
Nummer and Peter Carr and some of the guys out there. Yeah.
yeah.
So you know, I've known Peter and Bill since 2005, and I used to be one of these sports books. I used to work for Ladbrokes. I was a director there for a number of years.
Right.
So my connection with that part of the business has been, you know, for a good 15 plus years now. And yeah, we've had a very strong relationship with those guys, and you know, they've benefited from that significantly over the years, and we know what the model is, and we think there are many other ways in which we could help people.
How much have they benefited? If you don't mind asking, by asking, is there a number that could be a model for you know, for a racetrack that runs, you know, 50 races a week? I mean,
it's hard to say.
Let's blue sky that.
It's hard to say, you know, what it's going to be, because you know, we look at how. As people who handicap in the U.S., who love horse racing in the U.S., you're going to think that, oh, if we send Keeneland over, it's going to do really great because it's great racing. But what it's about outside is the time of day.
Mm-hmm.
Is it full fields? Parks, because of their ownership, they were the first U.S. track to go abroad 20 years ago. It blows my mind when I go over and people think of Parks as they love to bet it. They think it's the premier rate, you know, it's the track they know because it was the first one in. And it's not our best racing, but it fits a great time slot. It was enshrined into the in the betting shops. But it can vary, again, how much people bet, depending on, you know, now we're sending signals to many different countries and different time zones, but it's the time zone. It's the number, you know, number of horses in a race, just like it is pari-mutuel.
Mm-hmm.
What else do you want to add to that?
No, that's true. Every time zone you move away from where the content is, it has a different profile in terms of how it's going to be received. There is, of course, an obvious home truth, which is it's always most valuable in the local area where it's being created. And therefore, look, we think, you know, there are significant opportunities here internationally, but the biggest opportunities are around when you're able to sell that content, fixed odds, back into the USA. That's where the real money can come from a fixed odds point of view.
For the US.
But you've already sort of, you know, there are issues associated with that, and there are calculations to be had around cannibalization and how that works for the various tracks in the various states. And so there is complexity to this.
You know,
we're not trying to suggest that this is, you know, a simple no-brainer. It's about how tracks take the view on the opportunity. But because there is this really big audience that currently is not very well addressed, and because there is the opportunity, from our point of view, to be able to bring in a lot of international content to be able to test the water and generate revenues for US racing, then the conditions are becoming, we think, pretty good to start to do this and to learn from experience and start to introduce it into the marketplace. And that's really, you know, my coming over this time around and working with Michelle and being here, which we're very pleased to be able to participate, is to share some more thinking and more understanding about how the various elements of this work, in order that people can make informed choices about how they want their states to approach this.
And if it wasn't for sports betting, coming from a pari-mutuel background, I'd never be recommending this. If we didn't have sports wagering proliferating the way we were, keep the monopoly of the tote. But that's changed now. We have to change. And, you know, one of the things we're here speaking with the horsemen about is they need to understand how it works. They need to understand the financial model to be able to make good decisions. And that's the key for us and why we're here.
What is the short-term and intermediate, obviously, you know, the long-term goals are proliferation, but what is the immediate projection and concentration and intermediate? What should we look for? How can players, what can they look forward to? How can they interact?
I think we're going to see, you know, state by state looking at this. No one wants to be the first. Colorado put their hand up and said they did on the sports side. So I think we're going to really be watching what Colorado does. If these draft regulations pass at the next gaming meeting, you know, we could be looking at midsummer. But just because they approve it doesn't mean you're, like, the light's going to go on and it's going to be great. We now have to get sports books to take it, to do the commercial deals, and do the technical integration. This is not simulcasting. You know, and we go into a lot of racetracks and they're like, well, we'll just sell it ourselves as sports books. It's not how it works because, again, there's no tote, there's no pool. You need prices. You know, not only how we package up how customers watch the races and the data, the program, we all have that, but how is it priced? And you're going to see some sports books have their own trading team. They're going to trade it. Sometimes they're going to rely on managed services, such as what we do, and just even starting prices. So that makes it much different than simulcasting. So there's still a lot of work to do, even if the regulations fall. And the agreement within each state, you know, whether it's negotiating with the industry group as to what's fair. And the pricing model is really difficult because, you know, if you're sitting on the horseman side or the racetrack side, of course you want to maximize what you get. And you're on the sportsbook side, they want to pay the least amount for a product. And you got to find what works in the middle. You could price it too high and a sportsbook will just say, yeah, I can take table tennis. You know, that'll be fine. I don't really need horse racing. So it's a balancing act between the two. We want them to promote it. We want them to take it. And we want them to do the integration. And as you know, sports books have a lot going on. It could sometimes take 6 months for one to go ahead and decide to commit to horse racing.
So you're building the infrastructure with the state governments and with the back end, and your marketplace, who you're selling to are the books, are the...
Yeah, so we're here talking to sports books and have been for some months now and looking at their desire to take this and how they want to present it and how we can maximize the value of it for them in terms of the presentation and how it fits within their business models. And then we're talking to various states and regulators and horsemen and tracks about how the commercials might work for them when the regulation comes in place. And so, you know, we're trying to share as much knowledge as we have from the various ways in which this works around the world, knowing that in each state we have to put something in place that works for that state. So we're contributing in as many different ways as we can there.
And horse racing isn't new to the sports books. There's a number of sports books operating in the U.S. that also operate in many other jurisdictions around the world, and horse racing is a staple product for them. Yeah. So they know what kind of returns that they get from horse racing. They know, you know, what they pay for horse racing. So, you know, for us, there's a number of them that we already work with. You know, Entain is BetMGM. They own a part of our company. We work with Bet365. So we work with the big ones already with the portfolios. So, you know, it's not just turning it on, but they are familiar with us and work with us in other countries.
I mean, I think there's another thing going with the sportsbooks at the moment, which is, you know, you'll be well aware they've been spending an awful lot of money acquiring all of these customers, and you've seen this sort of announcement coming from Caesars where they're saying now's the time to try and tone down some of the marketing spend and start to make some profit. And they have to do that. And BetMGM have said they want to be profitable 23, 24. Well, one of the good ways of doing that is having a really comprehensive portfolio of horse racing, because you're never more than 5-6 minutes away from a result. And therefore, you've got customers who are generating good margins across a range of bets, potentially all of the time. And so the timing is pretty good, I think, because these sports books are now going through the phase of having spent a huge amount of money acquiring customers and now have to turn that customer base into a profitable customer base.
What should we read into Wynn backing out of their interface? Churchill last Thursday basically announcing that they're not going to pursue.
Yeah, there are going to be winners and losers on the sportsbook side. It's an expensive game, this one, and it takes a lot of skill to be able to get the balance right between acquiring those customers and turning them into a profitable business. And so there will be winners and losers here, and there's been an awful lot of money spent. You know, as Michelle said, that $3 billion number was last year alone. You know, and there's still hundreds of millions of dollars being spent on acquiring customers, and they've got to get the balance right. And some will win and some will lose. But you know, you can guarantee that they are talking to tens of millions of people that like to have a bet. And at the moment, those people are having their fixed odds bets on things other than horse racing.
I think the sports market, you know, when it becomes mature, we're going to see a lot of consolidation. We're going to see mergers and acquisitions happen. And it'll look different in 3 years from now with who are the players on the sports side. And that's natural.
We obviously, as a communication vehicle, anxious to hear, every signpost along the way. And I come back on regularly to update everybody and to communicate
you know, where the how the progress you're making.
Well, it's a pleasure to be invited to do so today. From our side, SIS is committed to working in the U.S. market. You know, we're working with Michelle, and we're pleased that she's decided she's heading up our organization here, because, you know, we understand that local knowledge and that ability to really interact with each state in the appropriate way is the right thing. So we're here for the long run, and we're more than happy to stay in touch.
Outstanding.
And I think, Steve, we all want the same thing. We want horse racing to flourish. You know, we're not here to make a quick buck on a sports app. We want to make sure horse racing is around for a long time and has new sources of revenue, greatly needed.
Yeah, no doubt. Outstanding. I can't thank you enough. And Michelle Fisher, who we haven't talked to in too long, and Richard Ames, SIS Sports Information Services. Where can people go to find out more about SIS?
Well, SIS, we're on the internet, so you can find us there. SIS Content Services Limited is the company that we set up in with Michelle. She's based in Kentucky, but she's everywhere, as you already know.
She turns up everywhere.
We will always be happy to talk to you. You know, we're easy enough to find.
SIS.tv on the internet.
Yeah.
And Michelle Fisher, of course, who everyone in racing knows.
Indeed.
Right?
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
We're happy to you know, do this on as regular a basis as needed, because it's a topic that people they're hearing bits and pieces and not all of it accurate about the prospects for success.
And one thing I'm going to say, Stephen, I know we're trying to wrap it up, but I have to say this, and Richard thought about this, is everyone's talking about the cannibalization of horse racing, of pari-mutuel to fixed odds, but horse racing as a whole in the United States is not self-sustaining. Let's look at that. Between slot machine revenue, VLTs, HHR, these are all subsidies that we see great purses in a lot of these states because of those subsidies. But they're not coming from people betting on horse racing. But putting this onto a sports book, it's people betting on horse racing. It's not a handout.
Yeah.
So it's a big difference. And you know, for you take a state that depends on one of those sources of revenue, they get a little cannibalization. So what? The purses aren't going to change.
That's for sure.
That's something we really need to think about, and that's different from state to state. So that's kind of what I want to close on.
Right.
You know, sitting here listening to you, it's great. I mean, it's good to see racing getting out of its comfort zone a little bit. We've been in a bubble for so long, saying, okay, this is our product, and this is only our product. And it's been 3, 4, 5 years now where we've heard fixed odds, we've heard sports betting, we're all trying to figure it out. And you said it perfectly. There's going to be some winners and there's going to be some losers. And it sounds like you guys are trying to ride the wave ahead of it. But it's, you know, we're all learning. We're learning from you now as, you know, you're trying to explain. And I'm trying to figure it out in my head how all this is going to work. But I think it's fascinating. And like I said, we're stepping out. We as an industry, we have to get out of our little square box that we've been in for so long to you know, advance and keep up with the rest of the world. So it's fascinating to sit here and listen to you tell your plan.
Thanks, Rick.
That's great. Thank you.
Richard Ames and Michelle Fisher, and want to get, we've got about 5 or 6 minutes, swap that over there, and I've got to get Sid in here. And Dick, I did want you to also get some feedback from you in addition about, you know, your thoughts. Right there. There you go. Because you've been watching this with interest, and you saw the exchange wagering, you know, in the infancy of the internet before when it was the Wild West, and you know, players that were savvy to what was happening out there on the exchange potential, but then when the universe was tried to, you know, basically be corralled into one small. Not a small state, but you know, what are your thoughts?
Well, it was a lost opportunity that Betfair came over, tried to introduce it to a market that really doesn't embrace win betting the way they do in the UK, They should have known that going in. They made no effort to work with horsemen. I mean, just zero. And Ed Martin could tell you they did very little with regulators. So how they thought they were going to come in and get started and overcome all these hurdles just made no sense to me. So it was a lost opportunity that it didn't take hold and could have provided a new and different way of betting horses. So now we're on to this one. Now, the sports betting came along, like, all of a sudden, legally, court case, boom, it's here. And everyone is grabbing state by state, trying to hop on the carousel. Sports fixed odds betting is going to be interesting because it's going to follow a similar model because of the Wire Act. It's going to be state by state. You're not going to have I'm out here. I can't make my bets now because all my geofencing is on New York apps.
Tracking, yep.
So I got to go to the sports book here if I want to make a bet. But the good news is that I think states and tracks and horsemen that work together have just a tremendous opportunity to just get this right. And if the others aren't on board, well, that's going to be unfortunate. Some of them, as Ed could tell you, some of the states are just, they're only legal for parimutuel. And then the issue is, how do you do fixed odds? Well, with sports betting, that might be the umbrella that you can introduce fixed odds into that model. But it was just, I think we need it. And when you look at the numbers, I mean, New York is now doing $400 million per week on sports betting. And the bettors are killing it. One week, FanDuel did $175 million in handle and lost $2 million. So the bettors beat the bookies. Mm. Now, that doesn't happen very often. And yet the hold in New York is just over 6%, which is also very low. Usually it's 8%, 9%, sometimes 10%. So the challenge, like you mentioned, WynnBET, the challenge of expanding and everything is that much harder. And then New York is a special exception coming into a state with a 51% tax rate. I mean, you're on a thin margin to begin with. And then if the bettors are really sharp and they're not doing their job by losing like they're supposed to, then that whole model is like, wait a minute, we never really considered it.
We didn't think we were going to get beat.
So that's been fascinating to follow. It seems to be leveling out. But you're going to see some of these sports books just are going to have to merge and meld together and just have two, three survivors left because I don't see how they all can do it. WynnBET was a good example. Churchill, I don't really consider having been in the business.
No, they kind of just dipped their toe.
They talked about it. And FoxBet is allegedly out there, but I don't see any evidence of any activity with them and stuff like that. Clearly less than 1% of the market. So, yeah, if we could get racing in these different ways, not just what I'm used to.
Right.
I'm not the audience. You're not the audience. Rick's not the audience. It's these people that are walking behind us.
Look, those kids. We had kids parade
that
back
don't know anything about horse racing. They'll be the audience because they'll see something, and it's not going to be a learning curve type issue.
Yeah.
They're not going to just have to sit there and handicap and everything else. A race comes on. Here are the odds. Here's the names and everything else, and just have some fun with it.
Well, and that's actually a separate conversation with the AI elements, and we're working with Form to Win, for instance, and a handheld algorithmic handicapping tool that good for people that are going to play or they're going to play around every 3 to 5 minutes. Let me quickly say hello to Sid Fernando before we wrap up. Sid, good morning. I know you've been listening in.
Oh yeah, no, it's been a great show. I really enjoyed it. I got to say. I was just going, I have you guys on the back speaker on my deck, and I was just in and out of the pool listening to it. Very, very relaxing and informative.
Well, take a picture, if you would, of those three. A couple of things, Sid. We've got about 2 minutes, give or take, and I would love to talk about the pedigree of Secret Oath and of Un Ojo. How about the bizarre scenario that finds both of the winners this weekend at Oaklawn with stallions that are gone?
It's good that you said that because my comment TDN discusses the pedigrees of both those horses. So
nice.
Send your listeners over there.
Excellent. All right.
And,
nice. We'll do that, and I'll put up the link.
Do that.
And I also, since we're sending them to places to read Sid Fernando, tell us about the short story, which I think you could call a kind of a satiric short story of manners.
Yeah, it was, I just kind of knocked it off from my phone in a couple of hours and sent it to a few people. They liked it. So I just submitted it to, four publications and one took it right away.
I love it.
That yesterday, yes.
Yeah, so that's so funny.
It's just, it's just an amusing piece. Add some humor to the gloom we're going through in this business. And, I think anybody reading it will get a chuckle out of it.
TheRavensPerch.com. I forwarded it yesterday. We'll have a much fuller conversation when I'm with you next week. I'll probably be in the
absolutely.
Studio, all right? Thank you, Sid.
All right, see you.
Sid Fernando, Sire Watch Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hill & Dale. And this was a crazy 3 hours that saw us start with Dr. Daniels. Doug Daniels, of course, of now the new president and chairman of the National HBPA. Hammer, thanks to you and to Dick. Ed Martin with a really good piece. Pat Cummings and Adam Koenig, of course, talking about the breakage success, as well as Richard Ames and Michelle Fisher with this SIS educational, informative piece. So good luck if you're playing today, everybody. Back with you tomorrow, 9 o'clock. If you missed anything, podcast and archive. And we will come to you day two of National HBPA tomorrow. Thanks.
30 years ago, you'd have, some horse would show up in the PP.
Shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at PABred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Leader Shield and EPO Equine can help you? Contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-9 3-8-4-6-4-3.
Want to get your career in horse racing off to a fast start? Well, the University of Arizona's Racetrack Industry Program is your winning ticket. The Racetrack Industry Program has served as a springboard to some of the industry's most successful individuals, with a proven track record of job placement right out of college. If you want to earn a degree in the exciting horse racing industry, the Racetrack Industry Program can put you in the winner's circle.
Visit ua-rtip.org today.
At the Races with Steve Bick.